Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. Join me, your host, Alexia Gordon, as I chat with authors writing cozy, traditional, and historical mysteries. You won't find explicit sex or graphic violence. You will find intriguing authors and quality fiction. Thanks for listening. Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, author and host of the podcast. Leslie Budowitz returns to the corner today to chat about her new spice shop mystery, Between a Walk and a Dead Place. Welcome back, Leslie.
It's great to be with you always.
Now, please tell us about Between a Walk and a Dead Place and what your sleuth Pepper Reese is up to.
So Between a Walk and a Dead Place is the seventh book in the Spice Shop Mysteries. Pepper Reese runs the spice shop in Pike Place Market, where she sells spice and solves crime. In this book, we visit the Chinatown International District, also known as the CID, on the south end of the main portion of downtown Seattle. It's a place that has long fascinated me. And I got the idea to set a book there when my husband and I were visiting Seattle a few years ago. And we went to the Wing Luke Museum, which is a museum of the Asian experience in Seattle. And it is in the Chinatown International District, of course. And adjacent to it is a place called the Kong Yik Hotel. And it was a residential hotel from about, 1880 something to about the 1970s. And it was a fascinating place. It was kind of a boarding house style where immigrants, primarily Chinese, but not always, especially in the 20s and 30s and 40s, lived, often 8 or 10 men to a room. And then parts of it became a little more like the SRO's single residence, single
room occupancy?
Single room occupancy, thank you, that populated other parts of the city, including the market, and that are familiar to people all over the country. I wondered, what if someone found a body in the basement of one of these hotels, not the one that's attached to the museum, but to a closed residential hotel. And so I made one up on what was, when I last saw it, a parking lot, and gave it a history, and just had a really interesting time playing with that. So when Pepper goes to the Lunar New Year celebrations in January, the year of the rabbit, she goes to a food walk and a parade and runs into a friend of hers who comes rushing out of one of these closed residential hotels and says she's found a body. No spoilers. This is all in the first couple of pages, right? And Pepper, of course, helps her out and ends up getting involved in investigating the secrets of this building and how the body, which is brand new, got there into what is really this time capsule of Seattle history.
There's so many exciting things in your book to ask you about, you know, residential hotels and spices and ancient apothecaries. And well, I'll start with the Lunar New Year festival that you mentioned, because that's a very important festival, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about
the Lunar Year? It is. Every year in Chinese astrology has its own animal. And the year of 2023 is the year of the rabbit. And the rabbit is not necessarily the fiercest or wildest creature that you might anticipate, not like the dragon or the tiger or some of the other symbols of Chinese astrology, but it's a very important one, and I found it kind of intriguing. So all festivals, of course, have food, And there is a food walk, and Pepper and her mother and her good friend Sita go down to the food walk. And that's the first clue, because Sita is not a foodie. What is she doing there? Well, there's a little intrigue behind that as well. And I just had great fun thinking about and then taste testing some of the foods. My husband and I were over in Great Falls, Montana, and we went to a little Chinese restaurant there that's been there for a really long time. And we had just a great time just picking and choosing fun, different things. My husband is an acupuncturist and he has traveled in China. And so he knows a little bit more firsthand than I did. We also had a great time just thinking about the foods and then recreating some of them at home, because as you mentioned, there's always food in the book, and there's a few recipes to help the reader recreate some of the tastiest treats.
Hey, you mentioned your husband's an acupuncturist. Did that inspire the sort of ancient apothecary that occupies the basement of your fictional residential hotel?
So actually, no. The reason I thought about that as a possibility for the secret in the basement is partly related to his profession, but it's because there was is a restaurant in Butte, Montana, which is an old mining city and had a strong Chinese presence at one point, that has a secretive kind of hidden apothecary or pharmacy in the basement. And for decades, people didn't know it was there. Well, he got a chance to visit it and told me about it. And then pieces of it and pieces of another Chinese pharmacy from another Montana town are part of a museum there in Butte. And there's also a couple of others in one in Oregon and one up in Calgary that I was familiar with. And I'm not familiar with any in Seattle. I couldn't find any history of or any record of Chinese medical museum, so to speak, in Seattle, but I thought it deserved one. And so on the page, at least, it will have one. Lots of secrets in basements. And because of the history of that part of the city, and the way, the buildings were created after a fire, and because of regrades of hills, there's a lot of secret hidden spaces beneath buildings. And I thought it was just the perfect place to put something like that.
You gave us a little taste of the city's history earlier when you were talking about the residential hotels. And I'll admit, my only knowledge of that type of hotel comes from the, you know, movies from the 1930s, mm-hmm. which is a very different type of living in a hotel than what you described. So how did you sort of find out more about something that A, kind of doesn't really exist anymore, and B, find out about the side of it that was not necessarily the side that was, you know, on the big shiny screen for people to look at?
I do borrow from that image of the big shiny screen for the front lobby. And the hotel in my book, The Gold Rush, went through an evolution. It was first these boarding houses with several men living in one room. And they weren't all there at the same time, of course, because they worked shift work at the canneries and on the fishing boats. Then it went to a more traditional SRO. It was just sort of redeveloped into that. And I read this really fascinating book called Building Tradition, Pan-Asian Seattle and Life in the Residential Hotels by Marie Rose Wong. And Dr. Wong is a historian at Seattle University, which by coincidence is where I went to college. And she put together this amazing history of the closed residential hotels, many of them no longer in existence. Some still exist, but have become other things. It just wasn't possible or practical for many of them to continue when building codes changed and all of that. Of course, some of them are quite old and would not have been structurally salvageable. for modern uses. But she's got maps that she created and maps she found and the history of the that area. And she tells the history of the community that is now known as the Chinatown International District through these hotels. And I just thought it was fascinating.
With all of those fascinating historical stories to choose from, how do you pick the ones that make it into the book? Your book.
Always a good question. In fact, it's one I'm struggling with right now on book number 8, which is tentatively titled To Err is Cumin. There are so many possible stories, it's hard to choose from them. And one of the things I learned, and I'm sure that you learned too, fairly early on in writing fiction, is there are so many possibilities, and at some point you just have to decide. You just have to decide it is going to be this way and this way and get to the end. And on your way to the end of that first draft, you may discover something you had not thought of, something that had not occurred to you. I will avoid spoilers here, but what I'm referring to is the real treasure in the basement of the Gold Rush. I didn't anticipate that until about 3/4 of the way through the first draft. And so that is the balance that we go through as a writer. We have these ideas, we have to learn to figure out which ones are going to sustain a story, but also remain open to the ones that just come to us out of seemingly thin air, because we've laid the groundwork by doing our research, by thinking about the characters, thinking about the possibilities.
And speaking of balance, what's your technique for sort of weaving this history, which, you know, a lot of readers may not know about? So you have to provide enough detail to kind of orient them, but you do it in a way that it doesn't sound like you're reading a history textbook. So how do you sort of weave in the history to the story that you're actually telling?
That's another challenge, isn't it? Because whenever you research something, you want to share it all, and there's so much fascinating stuff, but you can only put on the page what is relevant to the story and what would naturally be revealed. So at one point we have Roxanne, who is Pepper's friend and a museum curator, who has been hired by the family that owns the Gold Rush to catalog the place. And she is showing Pepper and a young man who works for Pepper and is from the community. She's showing them around the hotel. And that gave me a little bit of an opportunity to talk about what the architecture was, what was on the walls. And that becomes important later, because, you know, the murder weapon is hanging there on the wall, not the murder weapon, an attack weapon is hanging there on the wall. And there are bits of the architecture, the furniture and that sort of thing that are interesting, but you can only put in there what really moves the story forward. Anytime you feel like you're stopping to tell your reader something, that's not good.
People's research process always fascinates me. So how do you research your spices? Because you use them appropriately. You don't just throw in some salt and pepper and call it a day. I mean, you go to trouble to make sure you're getting spices that both fit the theme of the book and the dish and the situations. How do you research which spices you're going to use?
Well, I always say that for me, research means eating. and that certainly was true here. It's interesting with Chinese food because it's not actually got a lot of variety of spice, not the way some other cuisines do. Obviously some peppers, star anise, a few other things that we associate with Chinese food, but it does not have the same range and variety as, say, French or Italian cooking does. It gets flavor in a different way. And so that was fun to read more about and to, as I said, to taste test in restaurants and then again at home. And one of the things I had fun making was the Chinese five spice apple cake. I saw a recipe for an apple cake that used Chinese five spice. Well, I wanted to make an apple custard cake. I don't know why. I just had the idea. I'd never done that before. I am not clan of the cake. I'm people of the pie. So where I got that idea, I don't know. But when I saw that recipe, I thought, well, I can do that. I can mix the custard cake, or custard pie I wanted to make, and just put in the five spice the way this more traditional apple cake recipe had called for. And so, you know, it's an experimentation. Not everything we try ends up making it into the book. If I don't think I want you to try making it, it doesn't go in the book.
And do you hear from readers who've tried the recipes?
I do, frequently, and it's really great. I love expanding people's knowledge of spice and giving them a few more things to try that they might not have stumbled across otherwise. Both the recipes in the books and the recipes from Mystery Lover's Kitchen.
And Between a Walk and a Dead Place has, I think I counted about 9 recipes, including some tea blends. Did you also develop the tea blends?
Yes, that tea blend is my version of the spice tea that Pepper serves in her shop. When I was a college freshman and an 18-year-old kid, just moved from Montana to Seattle, the market was not long after what is still really well known in Seattle. It was not long after it had been saved from the wrecking ball. And it was still a little rough around the edges, but I loved walking around there, and I had my routine of where I went, and it always included stopping at a place called Market Spice for a cup of their spice tea. And many people who have been to Seattle or who've had friends visit and brought back souvenirs know that tea. I loved it back then. It's a little cloying for me now with orange peel and cloves and a few other things. A little too much for me now. So I created my own lighter version, and that's the version that Pepper and her staff serve. It's pretty easy to make.
And if someone decides to try your spiced tea, what would you suggest they have with it?
Fortune cookies, don't you think? Fortune cookies were another fun discovery. We all know them, of course, and they're a tradition in Chinese restaurants in this country, and I believe in Canada as well. But they are not originally Chinese. They were Japanese, and they came here, and how exactly they became part of the tradition of Chinese restaurants here is a little murky, but I tried to go into it a little bit in the book. It's a lot of fun.
And I actually did not know that until I saw a galley of your book, where I noticed you have at the heading of each chapter a fun little fact or quote, one of them about the fortune cookies being of actually Japanese origin. How did you choose those little facts and quotes to sort of head the chapters with? They're fascinating.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you enjoy them. Readers seem to enjoy them too, and I have fun collecting them. Although I will say, if anyone has a factoid about Seattle history, about food or spice that they want to share with me, I'd be happy to have it. And if I use something a reader sends me, I will credit the reader and send them a copy of the book. Because after 8 books, I'm starting to run a little thin on my quotables. I try to mix it up and make sure I've got Seattle history, market-specific facts, and things related to the story, as well as things related to the food. So I actually keep a running list of what those epigraphs are going to be. And sometimes they move around because they turn out to be more relevant in a different chapter than I originally thought.
Now, if a reader wants to either get in touch with you to share their own fun fact or tell you how delicious the tea and apple spice cake were, or to find out what's next, how can readers connect with you?
So my website is lesliebodowitz.com. I also write as Alicia Beckman. Leslie writes cozies, Alicia writes suspense, but they share a website, and they share a Facebook and Instagram pages as well. And on Facebook, it's Leslie Bodowitz author, And Instagram, it is just Leslie Buttowitz. So any of those ways are a great way to keep up with me to see what's coming next. And if someone's maybe interested in attending an event that I'm holding, a reading or a library event, I'm always happy to meet with readers. That's the best way to see what that schedule is. Newsletter subscribers do get a free short story. Currently, it is one called The End of the Line, which is set in Greece, involving an elderly Greek man who really seriously hates change. And I'm always happy to hear from readers and love corresponding with them.
And where can readers buy a copy of Between a Walk and a Dead Place?
All the usual places, both online booksellers and local booksellers. Independents are the lifeblood of the mystery and book-loving community, and I do encourage readers to support an independent bookseller whenever they can. But of course, the online booksellers are very important too. The book will be available July 18th in paperback and ebook. And I'm not sure whether the audiobook will be ready by July 18th or not, but it'll be darn close. I can tell you that.
Well, thank you very much, Leslie, for coming back to chat with me about your new book. Now I'm hungry. And I'm sure readers will be hungry to read more about Pepper and her friends as they solve this latest mystery. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Alexia. It's always a pleasure to visit with you, whether it's online or in person.
And thank you, readers, for tuning in to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I have been chatting with Leslie Buttowitz, author of Between a Walk and a Dead Place, the newest spice shop mystery. I'm Alexia Gordon, your host. Until next time, goodbye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, your host. Please support the podcast by leaving a 5-star rating or review on whatever platform you listen on. Follow the podcast on Instagram at podcast_cozy, on Facebook at The Cozy Corner Podcast, and the web at thecozycornerwithalexiagordon.com. Follow me at Alexia Gordon Author on Instagram, AlexiaGordon.writer on Facebook, and AlexiaGordon.net on the web. Support me on Patreon at patreon.com/authoralexiagordon. And until next time, thanks for listening.